Hello, I'm Chris Basden, an editor with ASCPA's Journal of Accountancy. You're listening to the JFA podcast, where we talk about the key issues facing the accounting profession. This podcast comes from the ASCPA's National Tax Conference in Washington, D.C. on November 6th, where tax reform developments are the hot topic. To catch up on the latest developments, I talk with conference presenter Tony Nitti, a tax partner with Withum, Smith & Brown, and an editorial board member of the Tax Advisor.
So, Tony, thanks for coming on the podcast with us today.
Chris, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about tax reform today, and I guess the first question is, what is the current state of tax reform right now?
Well, that kind of depends on the minute, but the big seminal moment, the opening salvo we've been waiting for, was finally kind of launched last Thursday when we got 429 pages worth of the first bit of proposed legislation out of the House. Right, they're calling it HR1, and it is kind of the GOP, or at least the House's vision of tax reform as it stands today. And, you know, as I'm sure you and everybody that's listening is aware, it's what everybody's talking about. You know, it has created so much news, and as of about an hour and a half ago, so midday on Monday, November 6th, that bill is being marked up in the House Ways and Means Committee. And let me just tell you, if the remaining part of the conversation is any bit as contentious as the first 2 hours were that I was just watching upstairs, this process could drag on for quite a while. And that's obviously the House bill. Now, you know, we've just spent the last few days within the industry absorbing 429 pages worth of information. We got to go back and do it all over again, potentially at the end of the week, because the Senate has to release their vision for tax reform. And eventually these two things have to meet in the middle and create a bill that the president can sign into law.
Right. So what are some of the biggest changes that you have seen that have been suggested so far, and particularly ones that practitioners would be concerned about?
Sure. Well, there's a number. I mean, there was a lot of things that were anticipated, and then there were a lot of big surprises. So let's talk a little bit about what we kind of anticipated. The corporate rate is going to drop from 35% straight to 20%. There had been talks that maybe it would be phased in, or maybe it'd be written with a sunset provision to keep the cost down. That's not what happened. It's going to 20%. It's permanent. It's supposed to stay at 20%. Okay, so that's obviously big on the corporate side. On the individual side, we were told all along that the seven rates that we currently have that go from 10 to 39.6%, we were told that they were going to be condensed into three brackets, 12, 25, and 35. That did happen, but then there were some changes. So the top rate of 39.6% is actually going to remain. The thresholds have been raised a little bit, so you're only going to pay that top rate if you make more than $500,000 if you're single, or $1 million if you're married. And again, that wasn't totally unforeseen. What was unforeseen is if you make more than $1 million if you're single, $1.2 million if you're married, you're actually going to be paying an effective rate, at least for a little while, of 45.6%, because you have to claw back the benefit of the 12% rate. So it actually creates a top marginal rate of 45.6%, which, like I said, took a lot of people by surprise. Also on the individual side, from a deduction perspective, again, we expected to lose a lot of itemized deductions, not necessarily the way it flushed out. There were some surprises in there. For example, you know, we thought medical expenses were going to go away. They did. Tax prep fees were going to go away. They did. Same thing with unreimbursed business expenses. State and local income taxes, that was a huge point of contention. But right now, the GOP is sticking with the plan to eliminate the itemized deduction for state and local income taxes, even though that certainly is going to face some opposition from high-income states like New York, New Jersey, California. What we didn't expect were, you know, the real estate tax deductions capped at $10,000. The deduction for mortgage interest has been brought down from the debt on $1 million to $500,000, and any interest on second homes has been eliminated. So that took some people by surprise. Casualty losses, I'm really not sure of the policy reason behind it, but personal casualty losses that aren't part of a federally declared disaster area would no longer be allowable. So that, again, takes some people by surprise, because it means if your house burns down in a standalone fire, you're out of luck, basically, from a tax perspective. And then there were just some other things from an individual deduction perspective I don't think anybody saw coming. The deduction for alimony being denied. The deduction for student loan interest being denied. I don't think that was on anybody's radar. Changes made to the exclusion from the sale of a primary residence that are going to make it more difficult to get that exclusion. Again, I don't think a lot of people saw those coming. And so on the individual side, we saw the predicted cuts, but not quite as steep as we thought. And then we saw more revenue raisers than probably anybody realized was going to come. But you have to raise that revenue if you're going to pay for that steep corporate tax cut that we talked about. And then maybe the most controversial, most talked about aspect of this plan, and certainly the most highly anticipated part, is the change in the way we treat the income of S-Corp shareholders and partners and partnerships. Because, you know, that type of income, traditionally and under current law, it's not taxed at the business level. The owners pay tax at the individual level, where they're at the mercy of their individual rates. And as we said, under current law, those rates go as high as 39.6%. Well, President Trump has said, hey, no more of that. We're going to change the law so that partnership and S-Corp income, when it gets to the owners, is taxed at a flat 25%. And that's what, at least in the first few sentences, this proposed law would do. But that's about the surface level is about the only way you get that 25% rate. The reality is far different. And that's what the industry is struggling to get their arms around. And the reality is that very limited S-Corps and partnerships will get the benefit of this 25% rate on their income. For example, if you are an active participant in the business, the default is that 70% of your income from the business is not subject to the preferential rates. It's actually taxed at ordinary rates, which, as we just said, could go as high as 45.6%. Even worse, you know, if you're a personal service business like an accounting firm, a law firm, the default is that 0% of your flow-through income is subject to the preferential 25% rate. So not only do you not all end up any better under this law, it could actually end up a little bit worse because the top marginal rate has actually increased. And so people are really struggling to make sense of the flow-through rule, because the only way to get 100% of your flow-through income to be subject to the 25% rate is to be a passive investor. And that seems counterintuitive, right? Saying if you do nothing, you get a 25% rate. But if you show up at work every day and bust your hump, the best you could hope for is a 25% rate on 30% of your income, potentially. And so I don't know if that survives because of the controversy it has created and will continue to create, but these are the things people are really talking about around the industry.
Absolutely. So as you point out, there can certainly be a lot of changes that can still be made to it. But based on the things that you've just talked about, are there practitioners with a particular focus area or client type or practice area that you think should really be paying extra special attention right now?
Sure. I think if your sweet spot for clients is really in that, say, I hate using terms like this because it varies so much, but say upper middle class, right? Say someone that's going to make $200,000 to $400,000 and maybe is a small business owner, you might actually find that upper middle class, even though the middle class has been kind of earmarked as the primary beneficiaries of this plan, at least that's what was intended, you may find that when you crunch the numbers based on the changes that I just laid out for you, a lot of people in that range are going to actually experience an increase in their tax bill, right? And it's because their itemized deductions are being stripped away, and so are their personal exemptions, and they're not benefiting from an increased standard deduction, and they're not benefiting from increases to the child tax credits because they make too much money to claim those credits. And so what I'm finding in my kind of preliminary analysis is that, again, that upper middle class range, particularly if you're in a high income state like in New Jersey, New York, California, you might actually see your bill go up under this plan. And then the other thing is, if you kind of ply your trade with clients that are predominantly flow through businesses, you know, S-Corps, partnerships, you really have to take a close look because of the changes that I just mentioned, where, as crazy as it sounds, with the corporate rate going to 20%, and so much of the flow-through income still being taxed at ordinary rates as high as 45.6%, you suddenly end up in this situation we haven't been in decades, where C corporations might kind of enjoy a resurgence, right? Where it suddenly might become kind of more of a golden era for C corporations just because of the confluence of changes.
So what do you think that practitioners should be telling clients who are calling them and saying, hey, what's going on? Is there anything they can tell them at this point?
I mean, you you know, you can't tell them anything with certainty, but you have to communicate with your clients. Because look at it this way, right? I'm a tax guy, which means for the better part of my career, as soon as people that know me found out I'm a tax guy, it's pretty much the last thing they want to hear from me, right? Nobody cares what I have to say. And, you know, at my kids' birthday parties, no one's going to, when they find out you're a tax guy, no one's curious what you have to add. Right now, that's different. Right now, you tell, you know, parents at your kid's birthday party, you're a tax person, everyone's got the same question. What's this mean for me? What's going to happen? What's real? What's not? And so that means every one of our clients is like one of those parents at a birthday party. Every one of them wants to know, what does this mean to me? And I know plenty of practitioners that kind of want to err on the side of saying, you know, because tax reform is always in flux, ever-changing, it's a futile gesture to try to keep up with it. So just wake me up when it's finalized and I'll deal with it. Then I don't think that's a smart approach, because your clients are reading about this stuff now, not in the Tax Advisor, but in the USA Today, right? And they're not hearing about it on NPR. They're hearing about it on their favorite, you know, morning drive time radio show. Everyone's talking about tax reform. And so if you can't speak intelligently about these changes, and look, I concede it is a pain to keep up with these changes, but if you can't speak intelligently about a House bill, about the Senate bill, you know, about the headlines that are being made, I just think you run the risk of your clients losing confidence in you as a tax practitioner. So when you speak to your clients, you obviously couch it all. You obviously throw the caveats in that, hey, none of this might become law. But if it does, here's what we're going to do to be prepared. And I think you owe it to your clients to do that. And I think you put yourself in a tremendous competitive advantage over other practitioners, you know, if you're keeping track of reform while others don't.
Absolutely. So again, understanding that, you know, the political process is going to take it can take many turns in unexpected directions. Do we have a sense of what the time frame might be for passing some kind of tax reform at this point?
Well, the time frame might be my personal biggest point of contention with all of this, because there's no tremendous reason to rush through this process. But that's exactly what's being promised to us, right? I mean, the economy's doing well, stock market's all-time highs, real estate market's bouncing back. There's no tremendous motivation for tax reform as kind of an economic stimulus, but yet we're being told that they want to have this entire reform done and signed, sealed, delivered by Christmas. And, you know, again, I just finished watching the first 2 hours of the House markup of the bill, and most of the complaints at this point aren't about what's in the bill. It's about the process, about how quickly this is being sped up with no public hearings, trying to get a House, you know, bill voted on before Thanksgiving, and then, a bill voted on before Thanksgiving or around Thanksgiving, and then ultimately signed into law by Christmas. And it borders on a bit of hubris, because, you know, the process back in 1986, which is what everyone's kind of hoping to duplicate here within the GOP, you know, it took about 14 months from proposed legislation to finalization. Here they're saying we can do this in 4 weeks. So it could happen very quickly, because the GOP certainly needs a legislative victory. I don't know that it should happen very quickly or that it needs to, but it could happen quickly and be effective 1/1/18. Or we could see the same type of infighting that we saw with health care reform, and this could drag on much longer than it potentially would have if we had just taken our time from the beginning. So, you know, it's one of those situations where nobody can predict anything. You just kind of got to grab your box of popcorn, sit back, and watch it unfold.
So what are some of the challenges that you see to this particular legislation getting passed right now?
Oh, I think the biggest challenge that I see, maybe there's two of them. Number one, you know, you've got a couple. The way they're hoping to push this through is what's called the reconciliation process, which means you only need 50 votes out of the Senate, where Republicans control 52 seats. That should seem like it's easy to garner, but, you know, there's four or five Republicans that were very, you know, the GOP is very wary of in terms of getting a yes vote, particularly because this particular tax bill would add $1.5 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. And there are certainly some, even on the Republican side, that just say, hey, I can't in good conscience vote for debt finance tax cuts. So that's going to be one issue. The second issue, and you're really going to start to see this emerge in the coming days and weeks, is that this has been packaged as a middle-class individual tax bill. But now that the tax wonks are starting to do their distributional analysis, the kind of, I don't want to say truth, because what is the truth when it comes to tax reform, but the reality, I should say, is starting to reveal itself that what this is, of the $1.5 trillion in cuts, is effectively a $1 trillion corporate tax cut, a $400 billion tax cut to passive business owners like, you know, real estate investors, and just a tiny bit flows through to the individuals. And the issue there is that I think the drivers of this bill are going to try to convince us, and they already have to some degree, that don't worry, individual workers will benefit substantially from the corporate tax cuts. And that's a debate as old as man itself, right? Who benefits from corporate tax cuts, the owners of the corporations or the workers? And I think the drivers of this bill are certainly going to convince us it's the latter, it's the workers. And then the other factor is just that some of these incentives they've built in to replace, for example, personal exemptions, they start disappearing in year five. And so even though today, you know, in 2018, the bill would look like it would pretty much provide individual cuts across the board, that starts to change dramatically in 2023. And all of a sudden, the middle class starts to see their tax bill go up significantly. The low-income people pretty much break even, and it's the richest 1% that are walking away with the benefits. And so as more and more of the public, the taxpaying public, gets an idea of who the winners and losers are, the more controversy is going to arise surrounding this bill, because it's just some of the things just look bad. For example, you know, in year five, the new kind of family $300 credit disappears in the exact same year that the estate tax disappears for the richest 1%. And that just looks bad. I mean, are there policy reasons for doing it? Sure. But if you're going to tell, you know, Joe middle class that his taxes go up in 2013, ostensibly so that some, you know, billionaire doesn't have to pay estate tax, it's obviously going to be create a political hurdle that has to be overcome.
So you mentioned the estate tax and some of the proposed changes there. How would those impact personal financial planners? Do you have a sense?
Yeah, I mean, the struggle is just to kind of figure out, when clients are waking up every morning reading in the newspaper that the estate tax is on its way out, they're not going to feel tremendous motivation to continue their estate tax planning. But if we've learned nothing else from the last, you know, 100 years of tax law in this country, is that even permanent changes are not permanent, right? It's only as permanent as whoever's in the White House. And so your clients could kind of walk away from the opportunity to do estate planning only to find in a few years, you know, 2020, if things flip and you end up with a Democrat in the White House, the first thing that's going to happen is the estate tax is going to go back in. So really, while there's not necessarily specifics you need to be advising your client right now about planning for the estate tax, it's really more just urging them to understand that even if the exemption does double right away, and even if this thing does disappear in 5 years, doesn't mean it's gone for good, and you just got to, you know, plan accordingly to do right by you and your family and be prepared for any eventualities that come down the pipe. So,
what can practitioners do to stay informed? And I'm particularly wondering about maybe smaller firms. You know, what can they do to make sure they know what's going on in their area of expertise?
Well, we live in a great time to be tax people, because within hours of legislation coming out, you know, you start to see the tax prep, the research companies, you know, whether it's Checkpoint or CCH, you know, they send out their summaries. Bloomberg sends out their summaries. You know, I mean, strictly from a shameless self-promotion perspective, I write about tax policy for Forbes.com, and I try to get my summary of the plan out as quickly as possible. But, you know, there's no shortage of ways to learn about this stuff. Even if you don't enjoy reading, you know, there's podcasts out there that go through this. There's radio interviews. But there's no shortage of great write-ups. Look, if you want to go straight to the source, I mean, within days, the Joint Committee of Taxation puts up their summary of the bills, and it's written in plain English. And it says what the law was, what the motivation is to change it, and what the law is now. Is it the easiest reading? No. Is it far easier than reading the actual bill itself? Absolutely. Right? So there's all different ranges. You could read the bill if you're absolute glutton for punishment. You can read the Joint Committee of Taxation summary if you still want that high-level understanding. Or you could, if you enjoy your reading to be a little more rife with typos and arcane Simpsons references, you can go to my stuff on Forbes.com, whatever makes you happy. But there's no shortage of information. There was a time and place where maybe it was harder to learn about what was happening. That's not the case anymore.
Is there anything else about this that you think is important to point out that practitioners should know?
Yeah, I mean, again, just to kind of reiterate what I said before, don't miss this opportunity. Embrace it, right? Don't be frustrated that this, you know, the body of law that we make our careers in appears to be in such a state of flux. Embrace it as an opportunity to win new clients by showing that you're proactive, by, you know, making a lifelong client by showing your current stable of clients that, again, you have their best interests in mind, right? And just enjoy the limelight for a while, because soon tax people are going to be right back in the shadows and no one's going to care what we have to say. But for now, when someone asks you, you know, what's next, what's this mean to me, have an answer for them and have an informed answer. So tax reform can be frustrating. It can absolutely feel like a futile gesture a lot of times. But in our industry, again, these are the questions that people care about. When people take a tax update class from me for 2017, I always tell them, like, you might not want to do this hour on tax reform, but bottom line is, when you call your clients back tomorrow that you missed, you know, phone calls from today, they're not going to ask what's happening in the latest hobby loss cases or what's going on in the real estate professional rules. They're all going to say the same thing. What's happening with tax reform? I'm hearing about it. I'm reading about it. Tell me. And I would just encourage you to do whatever it takes to be able to talk to them about that.
Great. Thanks, Tony, for coming on the JFA podcast. We really appreciate it. And I'd like to also thank our listeners for listening today.
Thanks, Chris. I really enjoy being here.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.